This is an AMI podcast.
Welcome to the best of Double Tap on YouTube.
Your chance to catch up on the videos we posted this week.
Now, here's your hosts, Stephen Scott and Sean Preece.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Double Tap on YouTube. I am Stephen Scott.
And I am Sean Preece. Hello.
Hello. And today I thought we would talk about the Apple antitrust case that's been brought forward by the US Department of Justice, Sean. I've touched on it on Double Tap on the Daily Show recently. Yeah, but you know, look, I know you're nervous about this, right? But no one's
This is legal stuff.
Us.
I'm very... Well, you say that now.
I have watched LA Law. Okay. So I am perfectly capable.
We are fine. Okay.
Absolutely. I've seen a couple of diagnosis murders as well. So we'll be absolutely fine. with us to discuss this, I thought, who do we get on? Who do we bring on to the show? To
legal expert.
Discuss it? Exactly. Who? You know, which? And actually, ideally, someone who's American as well, right? And I thought, who else? But Michael Babcock. Welcome back on to the show, Michael Babcock.
So that means I was the only American they could find at last minute to come talk about this.
Absolutely
I am
not
a legal
the case.
Expert.
for the sake of legal reasons, we will say definitely not. But yeah, probably. Anyway, let's get into this. So you've obviously been following this case like everybody else. What's your take on the DOJ's case? Are you pro or against Apple on this one?
So here's the irony is I really haven't been following this case. And I kind of am at the point where a lot of people have said this. I know you've said this. I know several other professionals have said this as well. And that is the DOJ just needs to wait until iOS 18 comes out because a lot of these have already been addressed. So what is the point of this aside from it's let's make a stand against big tech? Conveniently during an election year.
Well, I mean, you say you haven't followed it, but you've pretty much nailed it as far as I'm reading it. I mean, that seems to be my... I just think it's interesting from your perspective, because this is very much a US case in the way that the EU was fighting back against Apple and won. And some would say it was a good thing because we got USB-C out of it. Thank you, EU. If you don't thank them for anything else, you can thank them for that. But, you know, it does seem like they were... The U.S. Department of Justice were emboldened by the case in the EU. That's the impression I get, and it kind of emboldened them to bring this forward. We should say this has been ongoing now, or at least been prepared for a number of years. And I guess it's maybe the time that it's taken to get this argument out that has perhaps been the problem here, because tech moves on so quickly, right?
Well, yeah, tech moves on quickly, and... I don't know that we can blame the EU or thank the EU for USB-C, because it's not like Apple got the ruling from the EU last year and said, oh, we better switch our next iPhone to USB-C. That's obviously something that's been in the works for quite a while now. And so I think they kind of fell into the aspect that the US is falling into as well. Why not just wait a little bit? But how long is waiting a little bit worth? One of the things that's been brought up is the iMessaging aspect. And if you are an Apple user, then you get iMessaging. But if you switch to Android, then you don't get iMessaging. And I've never, like, it frustrates me being someone who goes back and forth between devices, iOS and Android, that a lot of my conversations can be broken. But I also get why I don't have iMessaging on Android or Windows, because those aren't Apple-owned products. That's like me saying, I want to use WhatsApp and call my son who doesn't have WhatsApp. So why isn't WhatsApp in trouble for you having to have WhatsApp on your phone in order to communicate with it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd firstly say, why hasn't he got WhatsApp? Because WhatsApp is absolutely everywhere. But I get that.
Well,
I want
to come back to that point. That's a really interesting point. We'll come back to that.
Super app. Kind of. Yeah, okay. So, look, when it comes down to iMessage, though, and your point about, you know, the EU just didn't say, we're looking at USB-C, and then suddenly Apple changed. I think they did. I think they did, because they knew it was coming. EU weren't quiet about this. Of course, there was that where they proposed the bill and then passed it and all that. But before that, it was known that this was coming, and this was a problem that they were highlighting. And I think it's exactly the same with the DOJ. I don't for one second believe that Apple were caught by surprise, like last week suddenly going, oh no, this is happening. I think they've known for the longest time why they've started to make moves into iMessage supporting the RCS, the Rich Communication Service Protocol.
Well, let's break this down a little bit, because it seems to me the argument is about SMS, not RCS, but SMS, which is original. Yeah, exactly. But that was the original. That was the original text messaging protocol, right? And that's what is in place at the moment. And the issue seems to be that because Apple hasn't adopted this rich communication system, RCS, which would make the ability to send messages and pictures and emojis and all those things across between Apple and Android, because they haven't brought that in yet, that is something that they should be, I would appear taken to court over. But as you said, Michael, that's going to be fixed. And I've been saying this as well. It's going to be fixed in iOS 18. Now, there's another argument here, which is that apparently Apple are going to be using a 2019 version of RCS. So clearly someone hasn't paid their license fee for the updated version. Maybe Tim Cook could get his credit card out on that one and maybe just upgrade that. And then that could solve that issue. But it seems that even if and when this comes in with iOS 18, it's still not going to be perfect, and it might even result in a slightly lesser secure and lesser private messaging between Apple and Android. So in some ways, this ruling or this case might actually push more or create more problems than it solves or aims to solve.
Yeah, that's interesting, because when you're still in the Apple ecosystem, you have the, maybe you don't understand conceptually everything that's going on, but you know, hey, my messages are secure between me and that person. But when you open it up to Android, it definitely can give you a little pause and say, hey, at least right now, when I send a message, it says text message when I'm sending to an Android user. It might say rich communication message or RCS message when iOS 18 comes out and the support comes out. But you do have those security challenges that might come into play when you're crossing over different platforms.
Now, Sean, you mentioned WhatsApp. And yes. I was talking to someone today about this, and it was interesting because they had said to me, you know, it's funny because in Europe, the UK and Europe and in other parts of the world, lots of people use WhatsApp. But in America, it's not that popular. So
really?
It seems to be the most popular app of messaging choice on an iPhone for Americans is iMessage, not others. Now, I'm not saying that Americans aren't using WhatsApp, but the number of people, the total number of people using iMessage is much higher in the US using iPhones than it is outside of the US. And that's interesting. We are more prepared, it would seem, outside of America to be willing to try all these different apps out. Less so in the States. Now, Michael, I don't know if that's your experience.
Yep, it is. And the people that I am connected with that don't use WhatsApp just use iMessages or the default messages app on their Android phone because it's right there. They don't have to go download something. It's perceived that it's a long sign-up process to set up an account. And then some individuals I've talked to said, well, what's the point? I already have messaging on my phone. I don't need to go get another app to message with people. I think what helps people with wanting to use WhatsApp, at least in the US from what I've observed, is I need to contact someone that my carrier is going to charge me an outrageous price to deliver that message to. And if I'm talking to people internationally, a lot of times I might just stick with iMessages, or if I want to send them voice messages, then I'm going to go into WhatsApp. But really it comes down to the cost of, if I'm just texting someone and it's here in the US, I'm just going to use the basic messaging service. If I need to contact someone outside the US, I'll try to see if they're on iMessages, and if they're not, then maybe I'll look at this WhatsApp or go to Facebook Messenger.
But why should they have to go to WhatsApp and not do it from iMessage? I mean, because there's no reason why there should be a charge for an iMessage sending an SMS. So the short message system, right, the SMS and the MMS as well,
yeah,
which was brought about for sending media via text message. So sending pictures, basically. So those two have been around for decades and decades, right? Mm-hmm. So they are being replaced with RCS, which is all of it into one, you know, being able to send audio, video, pictures and text messages, as we're so used to with apps such as iMessage and WhatsApp. So the fact of the matter is that Apple have so far chosen not to support this new protocol replacing SMS. Now, to talk about encryption and privacy, RCS supports encryption except for the protocol or the version that Apple have chosen so far. So again, it's a decision made by Apple to limit what functionality RCS has when it comes to communicating across platform. So this is all down to Apple. There isn't a case of...
Okay, I get that, but I'll concede some of that. But what I would also say is that the SMS system, which they are blaming the poor experience, the green bubble versus the blue bubble, essentially, that's the result for the consumer. That's not Apple's fault. They didn't design it. They didn't build it. They use it. They utilize it. So if they're getting blamed for a system which is not suitable, why would Apple be to blame for that?
Because SMS isn't up to the standard that we're so used to now with every other messaging app, not just iMessage. And the fact of the matter is that RCS has been made to offer those level of services, to offer high definition photo transfer and video and audio. And the fact of the matter is that Apple are yet again choosing not to offer the same standard to other platforms. They're saying, okay, we will go to this protocol of RCS, but you know, the video or photo quality isn't going to be great and maybe there won't be an encryption. Why? There is no reason why they shouldn't have exactly the same feature set as everything else.
Unless you go back to Tim Cook's comment of, oh, well, the messages don't come through as clear, just buy an iPhone. And maybe that's the gotcha, is to get more people on iOS.
But yes. Of course, but again, look, this is what irritates me about this case to some degree. They're going after a company that would appear for building something good. Now, I mean, is this where we're at today? Oh, here's a company that built something which actually works, that does well, which works within its own ecosystem correctly, which, you know, by nature is competing with other companies out there, and other companies aren't able to keep up. Why is that Apple's fault? I don't get it. I honestly don't get it. What am I missing here?
I think it comes down to legal professionals wanting access to information. And if everything was the way Apple was with their iMessaging right now, it's end-to-end encrypted. So if someone wanted to get that information from those messages, they can't interrupt that information. So they can't be, I guess, fully informed. There was a law, I forget where it was. One of the states here made it a fine. They added a fine to Meta because they were allowing minors under 13 to use encryption on their devices. And it comes down to wanting to have access to all the information. I don't know why the DOJ is bringing this up now, but I think that plays a bit into it.
And, you know, I don't mean to get too political here because there's no way to avoid it. This is a political issue, and it's certainly going to become a political issue as we head up to the US election this year. But can the DOJ win approval here? I mean, I find it interesting because there's one difference, I think, between this case and the Microsoft case in the 90s, and that's the fan base that Apple has. It has a strong fan base, and I think there's even people who are not necessarily Apple fanboys or fangirls, but will absolutely be saying, you know what? This doesn't feel right. This doesn't feel correct. Now, of course, I will say there are plenty of people who'll be on the other side of that argument, and I get that. But there are plenty of people who are also not. And I think the fans of Apple here, I saw it referred to in the news as their stores were being referred to as houses of worship, which I thought was an interesting choice of phrase. But, you know, I think there is a difference here with the reaction of the public. And also the mood towards political leaders in our country right now, and especially in your country, Michael.
Mm. And is this going to stifle innovation for companies? Because it gives the appearance...
Don't get too big, or the DOJ will come after you.
Yeah.
That's
stifle innovation. How many times have we heard that trotted out as to say, oh, no, you can't make us do that. It stifles our innovation. Oh, come on. Look, I actually think there's some points of this that don't make sense. There's some points of this that are out of date. There are some points of this that should just be totally laughed out, right? But I think in general, I think this is a good thing to hold big tech companies, well, shine a spotlight on them, because it, the end user experience is all I worry about.
I'm shaking my head at you.
You shake your head, audio describe man. Look, the point is, I want to send my iMessage from my Windows desktop. Why can't I do that?
Well, you can. You can use PhoneLink on Microsoft.
Have you tried it? It's terrible, right?
That's not the argument. That's not the argument.
Why can't I?
You can.
Yeah, but it's incredibly limited, right? You can't send photos or audio. You can't send video. Why not? This is all software limited.
Microsoft built the app.
This is art of... Yes, but they're trying to work around limitations that Apple have built in. That's the point. And
Apple
it isn't...
might say, you can, though, just buy a Mac, and then you can use that
just
Mac.
Just buy a Mac.
You're in their ecosystem, and should they have to be supportive of everyone else's ecosystem? Because if Microsoft makes a change, then if that's the case, Apple's responsible for making sure that that works with the changes Microsoft made that maybe Apple wasn't aware of.
And well, let's remember how many times people have been able to use iTunes on a Windows machine because of the work that Apple did to make that available.
Which was awful experience, by the way. Please, don't make me.
The point is that these things are being made available. It just seems, I mean, I think you're right. I think the case, a lot of the information in the case is outdated. I think I would have thrown this out before we even got to this point where this case was brought forward. It feels like there is a case perhaps to be made around big tech and monopolies and competition and all of that. There definitely is a discussion to be had. I just don't think they've brought the right case at the right time. I think if they brought this case 5 years earlier, they might have had a point. But I think they're too late. And this it's interesting. I'm reading more and more people who are following on that side of the argument. Now, there are many people, like I say, who don't agree with that. And I want to hear from you. If you're one of those people who say, Stephen, you're totally wrong on this.
You're totally wrong, Stephen.
But listen, don't come back at me with the classic, oh, you're just an Apple fanboy. I'm not interested in that. That's not an argument. I've had those arguments by email already, and I'm not interested in them. That's not an argument.
Sorry.
Stop it, Sean. Don't tell me that I'm a fanboy and therefore I'll just apologize for everything Apple does. Even people I'm seeing trying to bring in accessibility into this and saying, well, they don't allow for third-party screen readers. Well, to my understanding, they do. There's nobody stopping anyone creating a third-party screen reader for Apple. It's just no one has. So I'm sorry, we need to get our facts right here in this. We've got to get the case right here. And I don't think the DOJ have done this. And by the way, on the accessibility point, it's not in the case. It's not part of the complaints. It's not part of the discussion as far as I'm concerned.
And let me just make this point, because I've been sort of saying how I'm all for this and how Apple have restricted. I don't think this is just an Apple problem, by the way. I think Apple have been chosen as an example because so many other companies follow what Apple do. I think the exact same case could be brought against any company you can think of, to be honest. Yeah. Google, Amazon, Microsoft, whoever it may be. I think Apple have just been the unlucky ones to have been chosen first. But I think there is a case to be answered. I honestly do.
Final thoughts on this, Michael?
I want to use my Pixel Watch with my iPhone. Why can't I do that?
It's a great question.
Wait for the next case against Google.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Well, look, we watch with interest. It will not be the end of the discussion because this is probably going to go on for years, and I don't really know the benefit of it. I will say, though, if the DOJ want to fully understand the issue they're facing right now, or they think they're facing, just think back to that 1990s case against Microsoft, because the work they did on that case allowed Apple to flourish. Think on that. Anyway, that's it for today. Thank you so much, Michael. As always, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for coming back on. You can check out, of course, your podcast, Unmute Presents. Unmute.show, is that right? That's your web address?
Yeah. Yep. Unmute.show. It's kind of a tongue twister.
Yeah, it is actually. It works. Yeah, you could fix that. But anyway, thank you. And come back soon if you want to talk to us again.
You're listening to the best of Double Tap on YouTube.
Okay, Sean. It's a tough topic, this one. It is a bit of a tough topic.
Oh, because, I don't want to do it then. Well, if it's tough, I'd know.
Yeah, well, we just go. Okay, well,
I want the easy life.
Like, subscribe, comment, and we'll catch
you again.
See
you next time.
Catch you again soon. No, it is a tough topic because I'm kind of moving away from tech in this one, right? I want to talk about how we essentially make our mobility aids more useful, but at the same time, not have them become an intrusion or become a problem. I'm going to level with you, right? So there's a lot of companies who are making new products. We talked last time about CSUN and the products on show, new products from Glidance. WeWalk, the smart cane as well, are getting a bit of an upgrade this year. Lots of great products coming out, lots of great ideas coming out. But to me, and I know there's lots of excitement around Glidance, and I know there's lots of excitement around WeWalk as well and other products, but and Biped, that's another one which people can wear, which is not something you would walk around with per se as a mobility aid, but you would arguably use it as a mobility aid. It's got sensors in it, and it can... it can see your environment essentially from chest height, so it would alert you to things you might walk into, like tree branches or that kind of thing. But I wonder if sometimes we're looking at this the wrong way, or we're adding too much to ourselves, because I feel life as a blind person can sometimes be challenging enough, and adding all this extra technology, which is feeding us all this information, is just too much. And I don't know what the answer to this is, but I don't know if this is the answer that's being put forward, or these are the answers.
I'm getting worried, Stephen.
Okay, why?
Because I'm seeing a theme here. I mean, we've had the episode about, stop saying we're replacing the guide dogs with robo dogs.
Unless it's a robot dog from Sony, in which case Sony, I'm all for it.
Which bites your fingers, but definitely not a guide robot dog. That's a no-no.
No.
You've mentioned this. It's almost like you're moving away from tech, Stephen Scott. Come back. Stop throwing it out.
Not moving away from tech. I love my tech, but what I don't want is intrusive tech that gets in the way and replaces or sits on top of the existing information I'm getting from, say, a cane or a dog. You know, you think about a simple walk to the store, right? You walk into the store to buy something, whether you get a cane or a guide dog. And I know there's a huge difference between the two. One is, alerting you to obstacles so you can move around them. Another is avoiding those obstacles entirely. But either way, you're still in control. You're still in charge of making sure the dog is keeping attention. You're still making sure you're aware of your environment with the cane. If you add to that a pair of sunglasses with audio coming out of them, perhaps there's a navigational aid in there. That's you adding another voice, or perhaps navigational beacons, which are telling you where to go. You're also having to cross a road at the same time. You're having to listen for traffic. There's a lot of information already available to you. Now, I'm going to overlay all of that with sensors and sonar scanners and whatever the heck else, to basically feed back to you with haptic feedback. Extra information about your environment. Goodness, there's something at head height. Goodness, there's something over here. Goodness, there's something standing in front of me, but I have no idea what it is. All that extra information on top of all of that, it builds up a sensory overload, which I think is just something we don't talk about enough. Yet tech is great, but only when it's useful, only when it assists us, not when it gets in our way or actually causes us problems, causes us even maybe mental pain.
Wow, that's strong words indeed, but I actually agree with you. I think, was it Amazon that used the term ambient computing at one point? Mm. And I think that's a great thing. Technology should just be there and sort of not noticed. Like kids, a lot of people would say.
Arguably, yes. Seen and never heard.
But the fact of the matter is, I think you're right. It can be a bit overloading. But is that a reason? It depends what you're saying, Stephen. Are you saying we should just stop with this? Let's just give this up? Because the fact of the matter is that maybe there's a form factor, there's a feedback method. Maybe it's not haptics. Maybe it's not, I don't know, something shaking your ears or whatever it may be. It's not audio. It's not visual, obviously. Whatever the feedback method is. But perhaps there is something out there which would make a total difference to the way we get around. And if we don't go through this cycle of, okay, we've tested that, that was terrible, we've tested that, that doesn't work, vibrating sonar sunglasses, they didn't work. It's not until we go through those stages of evolution that we reach, this is it. This is the thing that works and makes things better.
I get what you're saying, and I take that on board. What I would say is that I think that the solution is not in replacing what we already have. Okay? I think we do need something else. I think there's something missing in the sense of the, and you and I talk about this all the time, the last 10 yards problem. You get out of the taxi or you come out of a bus and suddenly you're facing a building. You have no idea where the entrance to that building is. And, you know, the information that is coming from technology today will give you information about door detection and all of that, but it's not guaranteed that it's giving you the right information. It's giving you information about what it can see. So there could be three doors. One might lead you to somewhere entirely the wrong place, you know, a different store or a different location or whatever it might be. And, you know, this is the problem. You've kind of got information, but it's not, you're not entirely sure what the information is giving you. It's telling you there's a door, but what is that door to? You know, so it feels like we're kind of getting closer to something, but we're not there yet. And it seems, if I'm honest, I feel like a lot of this technology that comes along, which is about mobility, is technology for technology's sake sometimes, because I have yet to find a reason why there shouldn't be a guide dog or a white cane in use. And until you can convince me otherwise, I don't see the point in this navigational technology, or I guess mobility technology, let's put it that way. Navigational might be arguably different, but this kind of mobility technology coming in, I don't see the argument. Now, one argument that is made, in particular around guide dogs, is the lack of them and the amount of money it costs to train a guide dog. And there's many parts of the world where people can't access that. So I understand that from the guide dog point of view. And on the white cane front, there's an argument that says, well, there's not enough rehabilitation support out there. So therefore, people are not getting access to the support. You've gone through this yourself. You've told us many times that you haven't had any mobility training. So orientation and mobility training hasn't been something you've had. So that's an issue. But to me, these are things that can be solved themselves. We don't necessarily need technology to come in to solve that. That's my case. I would rather there was more training for orientation and mobility. I would rather there was more investment into guide dogs. I think that's a good thing. And I
would agree.
And I don't know. I feel that technology is seen as the answer to every problem. We see this with AI. We're seeing that right now with AI, right? AI is going to solve everything. It's going to take all our jobs.
Yes, kill
everything off. But actually,
and save us at the same time.
But actually, the humanity built AI. We need to remember that, right? AI didn't just come out of nowhere. We built it. We created it. So, I think we're kind of missing a point here that we have something that works well. We talked last time about the all-terrain cane, which to me sees a really good step forward with the cane, because it's innovating the cane itself, but not just strapping a smart device to it.
I agree. I totally agree, but I don't think it's mutually exclusive that you have, okay, look, there needs to be more rehabilitation officers out there. I was reading a story in the news the other day about someone who lost their sight through diabetes and then was just left with no one contacted him. He didn't know where to turn. He just was just totally devastated for the longest time. And look, resources, making more resources available for people who are dealing with sight loss and more training, of course, is so important. And if someone, you could offer all the training and all the guide dogs and all the white sticks in the world, but if someone doesn't have that confidence and just feels like they can't do anything anyway now they've lost their sight, it's not going to change anything. But I see that as a different issue as to technology. These technology companies that have this amazing technology that we're hearing about every single day, AI, LiDAR, 3D mapping, computer vision, object recognition, whatever it may be, they are just looking for a way to harness this technology and to help us get around better. I agree with you. I don't think we've seen anything so far which I think actually hits the mark, that does do what it's aiming to solve. And I keep going back to the last 10 yards problem myself, but when I think about it, it's just more than that. It's the first 10 yards as well. How many times have I've been sat somewhere, you know, maybe I've gone somewhere with someone sighted and you sat there and you think, right, I want to go. But then I've got to think, right, how did I get here? Which way? So just starting off, it's something is really difficult. And I can't think of any technology that would help me with that problem other than my white stick or a guide dog. Arguably Ira, which is using technology to gain access to a sighted assistant. But
yeah,
that's
so you're kind
it.
Of back to where you started again, right? It's not
exactly.
technology. It's using technology, yes, but it's gaining access to sighted people.
Even that, yes, the service is absolutely amazing with something like Ira or Be My Eyes. Absolutely amazing once you get through to the human. But then you still have that obstacle, that intrusion, as you mentioned, of, okay, so now I've got to try and hold my phone here or there, and can you see properly if a rear camera? And, you know, it's still, the technology does get in the way of what you're trying to do. So I do agree with you, but I think it's something that's not going to go away, because I think there may be an answer when it comes to mobility navigation with technology. But how do we get there without through going through these iterations first?
Yeah, and of course we all have to remember as well that we're also paying for these iterations to
yes.
exist. These are not being given to anybody. I mean, yes, I know there's a beta test process that goes into these products, as like every other product would be the case. But, you know, at the end of the day, we are still having to buy these devices. And, you know, we may be finding that, you know, I think there's possibly data needing to be found here of how many times you've bought a device, whatever it may be, and it's just gone into a drawer. You know, this is one area. And I have to say, this is very common across a wide range of technology for disabled people, where, you know, sales figures seem to equal success. Actually, I don't think that's fair, because
that's
there are
true.
Many times a product has been purchased and then put in a drawer. And, you know, that for mainstream, that could be a Kindle tablet or a Fire tablet, as it's now known. You know, and it just lies in the drawer and never comes out. You know, that will count as a sale, therefore a success, which in the mainstream world, that's okay. But when it comes to our world, that sale might represent money in the bank for the company and might look good.
A lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In some cases, a lot of money. But it doesn't necessarily tell you the product has been a success.
I agree.
And I think this is where perhaps we need to, as a blind community, talk more about this. Get, you know, discuss this more, because we need to make sure that companies are listening to us, not five blind people specially chosen by a sighted organization, but actually, you know, a whole room full of blind people. You know, I think about what happens in America with the National Federation of the Blind and
yes.
the American Council of the Blind, bringing people together to have conversations and having companies come in and talk and, you know, get a real sense from a wide range of people, a large sample of people, what is the right product to create. It's partly why I think we get so excited when blind people build these products, because at least we know they have an attachment to the world that we live in. It's when some well-meaning person comes along, and I say that not as a slight, but they are well-meaning, but they come along with an idea, and you're either reinventing the wheel, which I think if you're replacing the white cane, you are, because unless that white cane does something extraordinary, and I think the Glidance is an example of something a bit different, because it's not being a white cane. It's doing something in between. It's a hybrid between almost cane and dog to some degree.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it has a little bit more credibility in the market because a blind person was behind it.
Literally behind it, yes.
Yeah, literally, yes.
I don't. But again, though, that's yet to be proven, right? There's
that's
a lot
right.
of interest,
yeah, yeah.
but it's
days.
Still, everything is promised. Okay, this is what it's going to be able to do. And people have got hands-on at CSUN and other places, and people have been impressed. So hopefully this is going to happen. But how many times have we heard this before? The promises, the potential. But you mentioned well-meaning people, and you mentioned well-meaning sighted people who are sometimes behind these technologies. But not only that for me, how many times has something been bought for you by a well-meaning, let's say, family member or relative? This I was told this would really help you, and you think, okay, actually this isn't. And this is another example of what you were talking about, of something being, you know, maybe put in a drawer and never touched again, because they were told that this would help a blind person or a visually impaired person, and in fact, in practical terms, it just doesn't. So
yeah.
Those things are out there. You're absolutely right.
Well, we look forward to your comments. Keep them coming. You can comment below. You can email us feedback@doubletaponair.com. Am I wrong about this? Should we be focusing on redeveloping a cane, or coming up with new technology in this space? Should we be innovating beyond the guide dog? There's an argument from some people that guide dogs, you know, it's not appropriate for the work they do. I've heard this argument levied a few times. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think that, you know, we should listen to all points of view on this. But as a result, what does that look like? What does mobility look like in 10 years, 20 years' time? I have a hunch it's going to look exactly the same as it does in 2024.
How dare you, sir? I'll be travelling around in my rocket trousers by then. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
This is the Best of Double Tap on YouTube. Find more videos and subscribe now by heading to YouTube and searching for Double Tap Video Now.
Now, you know, Sean, I love a little bit of fast food. It has been known for me to...
just a little bit.
A tiny bit of chicken. Yeah, usually chicken. But there are other places you can go, places that sell burgers, for example. Very popular. Mm. The great Scottish restaurant that I love to go to every so often called McDonald's.
Yes.
Yes. I love that one. Very popular. But the interesting thing is, if you go in nowadays, there's barely any staff, and there's these gigantic, almost like, you know, human-sized iPads that are sitting there, and that is how you're meant to choose your meal. That is how you're meant to order, pay, and all of that. And that's getting a little bit tricky. They're called kiosks, and, you know, they are quite tricky. I mean, obviously for us, kind of
quite tricky,
right? I mean, it's let's just be blunt about it. Useless, frankly.
We can't use them.
No, exactly.
You're right. And this is not just a McDonald's problem. This is everywhere. Everywhere is moving to this way of ordering food, you know, digitally. And it makes a lot of sense. You know, people can quickly order what they want, and it frees up staff, and it makes the whole process quicker and payment easier. I get that. But yeah, obviously, when it comes to accessibility, there's issues there. I've even been into a place and went up to the counter and was told, no, we don't take orders here anymore. You got to do it on the kiosk. And obviously, well, I can't do that. So someone's got to come with me and do it for me.
And that's before you even dig into the conversation around cashless. I mean, I saw a video on YouTube. I don't know how real this was. I mean, I assume it was real. These days, you have to take things with a little bit of caution. But, you know, it was a video of a guy who was in his elder years, and he was trying to buy something with cash at a store, and they just wouldn't accept the cash. They just wouldn't accept it. And, you know, that's another issue. That's another problem that we're having in our world today, is that, you know, even the cashless side of things is kind of disappearing. So, you know, the idea that we move from that to no staff and instead we're dealing with these kiosks doesn't seem that massive a leap. But of course, for businesses, it's a great way to save money because they don't have to pay people. And these robots can work on, they don't take lunch, they don't break down. Well, they sometimes do break down, but... You know, they're certainly available a lot more, and you can put more of them in. And we're seeing more and more of them be installed in stores now. And this is obviously a major area for us. It's a major area of concern, but it's also an area of opportunity. And on the show recently, we had Matt Ater from Vespero tell us all about JAWS for kiosk. And how, of course, JAWS, the screen reader for Windows, is being sort of rebuilt in a new way to accommodate these new kiosks and actually be built into them. And it's something that Matt Hader has been traveling around the world selling to different businesses, including McDonald's. But most recently, he was in the UK and he stopped by to tell us about what he's doing in the UK and what his hopes are for the kiosks themselves.
One of the divisions of Vespero called TPG Interactive is the, or TPGI for short, is the division who distributes and consults around kiosks. And we just solidified a partnership with RNIB to be the exclusive distributor in the UK for JAWS for kiosk. And this will be both Windows and Android. And we're just thrilled to have them as a partner because I think they bring the connection to the community, the connection to industry, something we don't have physically on the ground here in the UK, especially when it comes to industry like travel, hospitality, retail. RNIB is positioned for it. People come to them all the time from those industries, financial included in there. And so I think we love the fact that we've solidified this partnership and found them to be a perfect partner for opening the doors to the UK market. The JAWS for kiosk version again is available in Windows and Android. It's a slimmed down version of JAWS. It runs on a. I'm gonna break it down into a little further than just a kiosk, because kiosk, a lot of people think of those massive screens and restaurants or airports and things like that. And those are some of those types of products, but it could always be something like a payment device. You guys in the UK, I know this is a Canadian show, but in Canada as well, have had payment devices at the table for years. So if I went to the table or sat down at the table, ordered my meal, instead of taking the credit card and going in the back and making a payment like we do in the United States, the payment may be made at the table. And JAWS for kiosks, the Android version, can run on a device like that so that I would know what tip I'm putting in if I want to put a tip in. I can read my own bill. All of those kind of things that are necessary for somebody who's blind. I can know that I can tap my card, insert my card, tap my phone to it, you know, if phone payments are accepted. Those are things that, you know, when somebody hands you one of these devices today, you don't know any of this kind of stuff. And you're just taking, you know, their word that the price is right and the tip, if you want to put a tip in, is correct. And so other devices that you may find something like this on, seatback entertainment in an airplane, trying to think of some others that we're looking at. It could be on a workout piece of equipment. You know, maybe that workout piece of equipment has a tablet on it. You're seeing refrigerators with tablets. You're seeing microwaves now using Android to run them. Other appliances being run by Android. So the term kiosk could be broadly, say, self-contained device or something with a screen. And if it's running Android or Windows, we want to help make it accessible. And basically, you could walk into a restaurant today, find a headphone jack, plug in headphones, and if it begins talking, great. It may be us. It may be something that was built before us. And hopefully you can use it. And on that, next to the headphone jack, should be buttons so that you can navigate through the screen options. And so like a right arrow key would move forward through items on the screen, just like you would on a website, and left would move back through the items. And then in our configuration, up and down would move you through sections of the screen to make you, you know, after you've added a hamburger and fries and a drink to your order, you want to get to checkout. In our case, you'd press down arrow key to get to checkout. So you're skipping past all the other sandwiches so you can quickly get through the process. So we offer both the concept of using the keypad if it exists, or touch. And our touch experience, both in Windows and Android, would mimic the keypad. So swipe right would be very similar to using an iPhone today. Swipe left would go back. And then up and down are going to move by sections of the screen again, and double tap would select something. So, you know, the intent is to have a very simple user interface, offer you the chance to, you know, with specific commands, increase the speed or change the volume, things like that. And then it just comes down to, in some instances, offering privacy. You know, if you're in a healthcare check-in, you don't want to provide your personal data to everybody in the room. So that's why headphones are necessary, but also blanking the screen so that nobody can see what you're doing. And you, we're all used to that with iPhones, right? Where we can turn our screen off and have privacy mode, the screen curtain, and the same thing can exist on a kiosk for privacy.
So quite detailed description there of what kiosks are, and actually, perhaps more importantly, what they could be. And I think this is what I loved about what Matt talked about there, the fact that, you know, let's not just stop at the idea of those fast food stores and their kiosks. Let's think about going to a hotel. Let's think about all of the devices that are around us all the time that are generally inaccessible to us. Let's make the world more accessible in a bigger way. This is a good piece of work that Vespero are doing here.
Oh, this could have a massive impact. And to be honest, I think they're doing themselves a bit of a disservice by just using the kiosk label there, because basically this is Jules everywhere else but a computer. I mean, we talked about the tablets we see in, or the kiosks, let's call them that, in we see in restaurants. But I mean, just the machine they bring to your table once you've finished eating a meal to pay now. I mean, that's never been accessible to me. It's always a case of giving my card to someone or, you know, getting someone else to do it. The hotel tablets, we're seeing more and more of those. And I think it's a great idea because, you know, one interface to make accessible. And but most of the experience I've had so far is they are inaccessible. So, again, I think this is fantastic. This could have like a huge impact for everything we do in daily life.
You're listening to the Best of Double Tap on YouTube.
I am Samuel Green from Zoo North America, based in New York. Very happy to be here.
Very excited about this because, you know, blind people love recording audio, right? That's one of the things we love doing. For some of us, it's like taking pictures. And recording is great, but, you know, obviously a lot of us, like Sean and I, are allegedly professionals in this field.
Oh.
And... Yeah, I know. So it was news to me as well when someone told me. But, you know, for that reason, we like to record good, high-quality audio. And Zoom has been around for a long time doing this. For people who don't know the history, can you give us the kind of potted history of Zoom and how long you've been making audio recording gear?
Oh, sure. So Zoom as a brand was founded and is still based in Tokyo. That's where all the main engineering and worldwide sales happen. And started in the 80s into the 90s as guitar multi-effect pedals. That was the only business that Zoom did. And so obviously for musicians, that was all focused. And as we got into the 2000s, we started making some recorders, made our first handheld recorder, which was the H4 in about 2007, and a year later with the H2. And those products were built for musicians, only musicians. The H4N came out. It had multi-tracking and guitar effects and all this stuff. And we realized there are a lot of people using these for not music. And it was the same time DSLRs were going, you know, were selling like crazy. People were buying them for audio for video. And we hadn't put one feature in there that an audio for video person might need. In fact, we were scrambling for workarounds for all these things that they were concerned about. In 2013, we released the H6, and that was when we really embraced the audio for video. We had individual gain knobs so you can make quick changes when recording dialogue. We had two outputs so you can go out to a camera. Those types of features. And then we expanded the line with the H5 and all that. And then we turned around. Podcasters are using the H6 to do podcasts. There isn't a single podcast feature. They're trying to figure out, how do I record phone calls on here? And all this difficult stuff. It was not easy. So now we've got the P4 and the P8, which have the phone inputs and the sound pads. So, you know, it's been a journey of watching different users start to use our products and then adapting to really kind of perfect what a recorder could be for those users. And that's been a blast so far, which has led us to today, where now we have replaced our H1, H4, and H6, which were, you know, some of our most popular recorders we've ever made. We still do the guitar effects. We have some audio interfaces, some cameras with really nice mics. But obviously today we'll focus on the audio recorders.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting to me because I, for a long time, used my, and still do actually to this day, use my iPhone for a lot of recording, primarily because of the accessibility of voice memos or just press record or whatever app it is I'm using. You know, I've got full accessibility capability in this. And, you know, I used the H4N for years. I really enjoyed it, but I'm now having issues with it because of, you know, a lack of vision means I can't tell if it's recording, can't see the levels on it, that kind of thing. So, you know, really interested in the announcements that we're going to talk about today. But how do you find that market? Because people have got a really decent recorder in their pocket, but yet they are still going out and buying recorders like the Zoom recorder. Is it because of the name? Is it because of the brand? Is it because people want something that's just better? Or is it all of the other features that you're talking about, the fact that you can record multiple people and get that good quality audio?
And I think there's those two aspects. The one is The foam will work great until you need anything beyond just the single mic that I'm holding in my hand or placing down. So as soon as you've got a multi-person setup, a multi-instrument setup, you know, that immediately gets you going. I need to start looking at other recorders that can actually take these multiple inputs so that I can do full mixes and everything that I want to do. The other part is audio quality. And, you know, as much as the iPhone audio quality has improved and people use it, I find that it's pretty easy to convince them, you know, your story of, you know, discovering that the H4N sounds absolutely incredible. That's a very easy thing to do. You know, I love going in front of groups with an acoustic guitar and just putting down a Zoom H4N and hitting record and then plugging it into speakers without, you know, worrying about mic placement, and obviously no mixing involved. And it, every single, you know, I'm not never nervous about it because every time it sounds incredible. So that, you know, that moment of belief can happen for a lot of people where they say, okay, I'm no longer going to accept the worst quality because the better quality is so easy to capture. It's not a difficult thing to do. I just need this piece of equipment. And we'll get into all the ways that this new Essential series makes that even easier.
So talk us through what is new, and in particular in terms of the accessibility features. Tell us about the new features inside this new Essential range.
Sure. So all three of these, the H1 Essential, H4 Essential, and H6 Essential, have a voice guidance system. So, and it starts the moment you take it out of the box when you buy it. The first time you turn it on, the first thing it says, and it reads it out, is, you know, would you like to turn on the guide voice, and with an option for beep only, English plus beep, or off. And you select English plus beep. And from that point on, setting date and time all the way through the recording screen, it's on. So that's, you know, kind of the first experience when you buy the product. That's what you get. Now, once you're in it, theoretically, you know, every menu, every adjustment has either a voice readout or beep tones. You know, for example, the headphone output, when you turn it up, there's a higher pitch beep and it gets louder. When you turn it down, there's a lower pitch beep and it gets softer. And all, you know, in the mixer, when you're adjusting the faders, it will read out the numbers to you there. If you need to adjust your low cut, or you want to turn the two mics on top into a mono mix, all of that is part of that voice readout system for you to be able to navigate through. Built into the units when you buy them is English for that accessibility system. We do have 7 other languages that are available for download from our website and installation into the unit. So that's kind of the status of, you know, what this system really does. The other thing I'll mention that for accessibility, and it's not a feature specifically for that, but 32-bit flow recording, which is built into all three of these recorders. And to keep the explanation super simple, 32-bit flow gives us a bigger dynamic range, and it allows us to make a recorder that doesn't clip on the high end. And no matter how low you record, you can raise the volume without introducing a bunch of noise. Which, you know, anybody that's recording 24-bit and tried to work with very low level signals, you know, knows that's what happens when you turn it up. So because of that, we've actually been able to eliminate the gain control completely from them, meaning that you can turn on the product, arm the track you want to record, make sure your mic or whatever is plugged in, and hit record, and you're guaranteed to have audio that you will be able to mix into your final product. And you didn't have to do the gain adjustment to make sure. You don't have to monitor your levels to make sure things aren't getting too hot and all that. So it simplifies the whole recording process for every user. But I think that is a huge secondary element to why these recorders become incredibly accessible for blind and visually impaired creators.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing I hear about most, because there's nothing worse than trying to set your gain and being unable to see, you know, the flashing LEDs to see when they go into the red and when they're in the green, or that's where you spend most of your time trying to get that gain right. And if you've got, if you take that away, it makes things so much easier, less stress, definitely.
Absolutely. And yeah, I have very little experience using accessible products in the past, and I don't know what one of these recorders would have looked like if the system was in it, but I'm imagining clip tones going off all the time and it being not so fun of an experience. Yes. As you're trying to set levels, especially in crazy environments.
Can I also ask you about the audio interface part of this, because this always intrigues me. So this has an audio interface now. For people who don't know, that is where you can connect it to your computer and it can become the audio output and input. So essentially that means you can connect your microphones to this if you wanted to, external microphones, or use the internal microphones with this device and then use the output from, say, the headphone jack on that to listen to and produce audio, record audio, right?
Correct. And there's a... there's a few really nice features, kind of that revolve around that. One is that you can record to the SD card while you're using it as an audio interface. Mm. So especially for streaming applications, 32-bit float is limited in the benefits it can give you for streaming, because where you're streaming isn't in that, so clipping is still possible. Mm. But you can always record a 32-bit float backup on your SD card. That is going to be okay. So that's a really nice feature. The other thing is that there are, obviously, the H1 Essential with only the two mics, that's just a stereo going into your computer. But for the other ones, you have two options in audio interface, a stereo mix or the full multi-channel. And the full multi-channel is great if you want to plug in multiple things to record into a DAW or something like that. You got three musicians, plug them all in, record them individual so that you can do your mixing. For a streaming, you would want to use the stereo mix because you're just looking for all the inputs to get together into one stream that goes, to whatever software you're using for that. But there are some other ways that, you could use that stereo feature, especially with Android and iPhone. You can connect as the audio interface to your phone and record video with the audio being the audio from your Zoom recorder, but using the video from your phone. So the audio interface mode unlocks a lot of possibilities.
Samuel, it's been so good talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your news about these recorders. And welcome to the blind family. You've got all these new people who can shout at you and say, hey, make this better now. It's great.
You know what? I have to say the blind community has an ability to spread word and in a way that I have not seen another community that does it quite the same way. And it's been really, really fun to get to know a little bit more about it. So happy to be on the show with you guys. So thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the best of Double Tap on YouTube. New videos are published throughout the week. To make sure you don't miss out, head to YouTube and subscribe now. Search for Double Tap Video. Thanks for listening and catch you next time.
Join me every couple weeks for the Outdoors with Lawrence Gunther podcast, where we learn about outdoor tech and tips. Plus, we look at news affecting the environment. AMI's Outdoors with Lawrence Gunther is available from your favorite podcast provider.